Good afternoon. It's almost 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO-FM in Juneau. Weather for the rest of today is rain with temperatures steady around 57. Southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy with a chance of rain. Lows around 50 and southeast winds staying at 10 miles per hour. Good afternoon. I'm Pat Moore. I'm sitting in as guest host for Jeff Brown on today's version of Tuesday of Juneau Afternoon. This afternoon, my guests will include Peter and Luke Metcalf, who will be talking to us about next spring's Southeast Alaska Sports and Recreation Show. Becca Parks will be here with news of tomorrow's kickoff party for this year's LEGO League. Sarah Delio and Jessica Dempsey will be in to tell us about Saga's 25th anniversary. And Assistant Superintendent of Schools Lori Scandling will drop by to talk about the AVID program in our middle and high schools. One,
the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The leader of a Native community in northern Manitoba is asking the Canadian government to allow his people to live at an abandoned military base this winter. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the residents of his flooded reserve have been stuck in Winnipeg hotels all summer.
The Lake St. Martin First Nation is about 180 miles north of Winnipeg. Much of the reserve remains underwater or has been damaged by the widespread spring flooding. And it's costing about $100 per person per day to house nearly 700 of the First Nations residents in hotels. They were forced to leave the reserve in May. The chief says finding a temporary village is also in the public interest because it would save hundreds of thousands of dollars. The Kapyong Military Barracks near Brandon, Manitoba has been deserted for 6 years. The 126 vacant houses would allow the people of Lake St. Martin to live together as a community. And band counselor Merv Sinclair insists it would only be temporary.
We're not asking it as a settlement or anything. All we're asking is just for a temporary location till we can have our new community up and running.
The fate of the former barracks is now in the hands of a federal appeal court. In February, the court heard arguments from several Manitoba First Nations that they are owed surplus federal land and were never properly consulted before the government sold Kapyong to a government redevelopment company. A lawyer involved in the case says there's nothing legal standing in the way of the Lake St. Martin group using the barracks. The Department of National Defense is reviewing the chief's request. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A big concern among South Dakota lawmakers working on the redrawing of legislative districts is making sure regions primarily made up of Native Americans are drawn correctly. The state has been party in several lawsuits from those who think Native Americans are not fairly represented. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbold reports.
Every state has to redraw legislative districts once a decade to reflect numbers from the U.S. Census. South Dakota's redistricting committee is meeting today at the state capitol in Pierre. State Representative Val Rausch, who co-chairs the committee, says the state has been a defendant in several lawsuits regarding equal representation in the legislature.
And that phraseology is a little different than, you know, an equal vote, because we know by statistics that, you know, a lot of the Native Americans on the reservations, their voting turnout is different than the normal white district. We were mandated by federal law then and through the lawsuit to make sure that we look at the numbers a little differently concerning our Native American groups, so that when the day comes for voting, they have enough majority in that district that gives them then an opportunity to elect a Native American representative if they so choose.
Rausch says the 15-member redistricting committee is discussing ideas for drawing the new district maps, with public testimony welcome. He says the approval on the final map comes during a special session of the legislature next month. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
The U.S. Department of Justice is hosting a Four Corners Indian Country Conference. Associate Attorney General Tom Perrelli will deliver the keynote speech and make an announcement regarding the department's tribal grant program. Nearly 300 attendees of tribal and federal law enforcement, prosecutors, judges, and advocates in the fields of safety and justice are expected to attend. This year's gathering takes place Wednesday at the Sky Ute Casino Resort in Ignacio, Colorado. During this month in 1972, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was ordered to send a high school teacher to Amonik, Alaska. A lawsuit was filed by students and parents. The case eventually led to a requirement that high schools be built in rural Alaska. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you could get a payment of up to $50,000 or more. There will be meetings in locations around the country between July and December 2011 where you can get free legal help filing a claim. More details and a full schedule of meetings is available at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506.
It's about 5 minutes after three. My first guest on Juno Afternoon today is actually two people. We're here with Luke and Peter Metcalf, who are going to talk to us about an event that is coming up, oddly enough, in March. So the question is, why are you on the show in September?
Well, this is Peter Metcalf. It's 6 months away, it's true, but this will be a first annual event. And one of the keys to it will be to have the participation of factory reps, industry representatives, other experts who would partner up with retail businesses and other potential vendors. They generally need to plan their year, several months out. And one of the things we did with this event was schedule it for March 23rd, 24th, 25th of 2012, which corresponds with the last weekend of the gold medal tournament here in Juneau. And also is Sunday the 25th, just a few days before the beginning of the Great Alaska Sportsman Show up in Anchorage, which begins on Wednesday the 28th of March. So we think we have this thing positioned. And Luke and I and my wife Sandy went up to the Great Alaska Sportsman Show last spring and walked among the booths and got business cards and talked to many of the vendors and. And the industry rep types were very, very interested in participating, and so this would be pretty convenient for them. They could stop in Juneau and then go on to Anchorage. So that's why we're doing it now. We're about to send out applications with the brochure and all the information, floor plans, et cetera. It'll be in the mail early next week. So this is just the beginning. We got the public market coming up. As many people know, we been producing the public market since 1983, and which is about the year you were born, wasn't it?
Yeah, actually it was.
Luke's been working. Luke's my nephew and my oldest brother's son, and he's been working with us since he was about 7 years old at the public market, and over the years he's been taking on increasing amounts of responsibility. So with this event, we asked Luke to join us as a partner in the Sports and Recreation Show, and he'll be in charge of operations.
So, Peter, you've called this the Southeast Alaska Sports and Recreation Show. Will it have a particular Southeast Alaska twist to it?
You never know until you get your vendors signed up, but I have a list of about 520 names, businesses, majority of them in Juneau, and a lot of them from Southeast, but we're inviting everybody from Helena tours to fish charter boats to adventure river rafting, as well as all the retail stores in Juneau that might be interested in participating, that would be selling outdoor gear or sports, guns and fishing gear and that sort of thing. So
a full wide range of sports and recreation.
I think that's the key to this, because we've attended a couple of these events, and the majority of them seem to be oriented towards, men's sports, hunting, fishing, camouflage gear, ATVs. Not that we aren't welcoming of those, we very much are, but we think for Juneau we need to cast a wide net, get women, families, children interested in what we're doing. And, one of the, I was talking to Dave Lindrum the other day, and he said, gardening is the number one recreational activity in the United States, so we want to see a good gardening component, too.
I see. But, so, Peter, you're the communications director for
right.
this. Luke, you're the operations manager, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So what does the operations manager do for this besides everything?
Well, during the actual market, it's just basically making sure that everyone's happy. Most, you know, you want to make sure your vendors are happy and ultimately the people showing up are happy. So a lot of times that's going to be communicating in between different workers that you have, trying to get things done efficiently and to make sure everything runs smoothly. And sometimes it might be anything from having to remove someone that might be unruly to getting a vendor a cup of coffee. Just being there and being visible and accessible for the most part and knowing what needs to be done.
So you're doing this in Centennial Hall. Mm-hmm. Does that facility offer any particular challenges to setting up an operation like this?
Well, with our experience with the public market, we have a very good layout and system for setting up our booths. And most of the people we'll hire have done it before, so we try to get it up as quickly as possible and try to get everyone in and into the market and then, you know, enough time to set up their booths in a quick manner.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask, since we've mentioned it two or three times here, the public market is coming up.
Right.
What are the dates and times for that?
The public market is scheduled every year for the Thanksgiving weekend, which, as you know, kind of moves around on the calendar. But this year it's the 24th, 25th, 26th, I think.
That's right.
But at any rate, it's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday following Thanksgiving. And this will be, I believe, our 29th annual public market. And as a matter of fact, just this morning I rented out the very last booth. And we also have the Juno Arts and Culture Center, the old Armory, is the public market annex. And that's where there was a few booths left, but just this morning those were rented out. So we're set to go for the 29th annual public market, which is hard to believe. But I'll just say this, I'm very glad Luke's working with us.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
Any highlight or anything like that? Is there anything that we should look forward to at this year's public market that may not have been there in previous years?
Well, every year we have turnover because, you know, things happen, people move on, or, you know, sometimes there's family emergencies and so on. And some people, a few people really, very few as it turns out, don't do so well in their marketing of their items. Most vendors do extraordinarily well. I mean, when I find out what they're pulling in, I'm always kind of surprised. But to answer your question directly, we have about 20% of the vendors are brand new, never been in the public market. About 35% were not participating last year. In other words, 15% of those that weren't here last year are rotating through from other years. But so if your first public market was in 2010, about 35-40% of the vendors will be entirely new to you, and it keeps the show interesting. One thing I should mention is that one of our vendors who's become something of a friend, Robbie and Elaine Garrett of Sagebrush Dry. They manufacture waterproof bags in Cake, Alaska. They moved their factory from Montana to Cake. And I visited them there a couple times. It's really quite an extraordinary small factory, but with state-of-the-art equipment. And it was last year Robbie approached me about doing a sports and recreation show. And my reply to him was, I've been thinking about doing this for about 15 years, but the key to it, as far as I can see, was getting industry reps involved. Because, you know, the way this thing is successful financially is we charge an admission to the hall. But people are coming in, and there's a bunch of retail businesses from Juno that are just doing what they do. You know, they feel they, you know, paid admission for something they could just walk in for free. But if you pair up industry reps with these vendors, then it's a whole different show. I mean, I like finding out about fishing reels, and to talk to a pin reel guy from the factory, that's an opportunity you don't get every day. So that's the sort of thing we want to present. When I said that to Robbie, he said, that's not a problem. I know all the reps. and he invited us to come up to the Great Alaska Sportsman Show where they had a booth. And by God, he showed us around, and all the industry reps were like, yeah, I'll come. So we knew we had a show. And then there was also the potential problem with the Juneau Boat Show, but coincidentally, they decided not to renew that show, so it won't be in conflict with the Rotarians' annual Juneau Boat Show that's been canceled.
And one thing Jeff just pointed out to me, the public market is the 25th, 26th, 27th.
Okay.
Of November.
25, 26, 27. Okay. And that's where most people do their Christmas shopping in Juneau, is because of the variety of things that are available.
It's become a tradition.
Yeah. Public market, November 25, 26, 27 coming
right
up. And this new event, the Southeast Alaska Sports and Recreation Show, will be in March on the 23rd through the 25th.
That's correct.
Both events are in Centennial Hall.
Right.
Be a little publicity in advance so people can get lined up with tickets and like that. But what you're looking for now is for people to contact you if they want to be part of the
That's
show.
That's right. And they can go to our website, which is alaskasportsandrec.com. It's alaskasportsandrec.com. And or just give us a call at 586-4072. But we'll be sending out these brochures and doing some other advertising so people will be able to contact us. But we also have a Facebook page, and pretty easy to find. But we do want vendors to at least inquire and we possibly get them squared away on a space for the coming event.
Peter and Luke, thank you very much for coming down and telling us about these events.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's 3:18 here at KTOO FM, and our next guest is going to talk to us about the first LEGO League and Junior annual kickoff party, and our guest is Becca Parks. Hi, Becca.
Hello.
Tell me, I'm looking at your poster here, and it says Food Factor. I'm wondering how we get the relationship between robotics and food.
It's always an interesting connection. Every year, the first LEGO League, Junior First LEGO League, they come up with a different real-world theme. And robots are a great way to get kids. This is a sports league for kids involved in science and technology, get really excited about what they're doing. But then we want to connect that to technological solutions to our big problems. This year's Food Factor, kids are looking at food safety. Last year, they were looking at biotechnology. The year before, it was transportation. So they're taking on those same problems that our main inventors and industry are trying to take on and solve also.
Becca, what you said kids, so what age groups are you aiming at here?
So this is all part of the FIRST program that is a continuum of programs starting in kindergarten, goes up through high school, and then the hope is keeps people involved beyond high school also. It starts with the Junior FIRST LEGO League, which is kindergarten through third grade or anybody under 9 years old, and FIRST LEGO League, which is fourth grade through eighth grade or 9 to 14 years old. And those are the two age groups that are targeted with this kickoff party. We also have high school teams in Juneau in the FIRST Tech Challenge. And then Anchorage has a team for the FIRST Robotics Challenge, and those are both at the high school level.
Okay. How does a child get involved in this process? How do they join you?
Well, the first step is to get excited about it and interested. Coming to the kickoff party is a great start, and that's tomorrow night at JDHS from 5:30 to 7:30. And then the one thing we don't do is actually form teams. So it's not like a league where you can come to us and say, I want to sign my kid up, sign them up, drop them off at 5:30 every Wednesday. We need coaches to get involved. So anybody can form a team, but they need to go out and find somebody who's going to take on the responsibility to coach. So we've had great luck in Juneau with just amazing volunteer coaches, volunteer teachers that have taken this on extra duty and stayed after school to help out teams. I know there are already teams registered at Glacier Valley, at Auk Bay, and at DZ. We have two Girl Scout teams, but I also know that those teams all fill up really quickly. So it's the kind of thing where every year parents come in a little bit later in the season, towards the end of September, they want to get somebody on a team. The best answer to that question is to form your own team, and we can teach you how to do that. We'll have a coaching clinic set up at that event tomorrow night, again, from 5:30 to 7:30. So parents or a big brother or a big sister or a troop leader can come and learn what's involved in being a coach and how to get more kids in Juneau involved.
Okay. Now, you mentioned a Girl Scout team and you mentioned a school set of teams. I'm wondering now, what if someone wants to join this and that isn't where they want to come from? Do you let other groups come in kind of like the Girl Scouts would?
It just depends on the team.
Somebody else can organize.
We don't set the rules for any of the teams. Anybody can form a team and anybody can be on those teams. The only restrictions that are set by the league itself are those age limits.
So I'm thinking particularly like homeschoolers could form a group.
Yeah, we've had homeschooler teams. We've had teams from the Boys and Girls Club. We've had churches that have put together teams, and then just a group of friends that really like working on it and want to be able to do it at home on their own time.
What's going to happen tomorrow night at the kickoff party?
So tomorrow night is just fun. We're going to have a lot of really great hands-on events. Kids who've never programmed a robot before will be able to come in and get started out on that. Then we're hoping to have a little bit more advanced programming advice for kids who've been in the league for a while and want to learn something new. We're going to have some food safety hands-on activities for kids to take on, and then some fun team building and engineering activities for younger kids. And aside from that, we're also going to have a coaching clinic off in a separate room for adults who, like I said, want to take on coaching. Then the big thing is we're going to go through this year's rules and missions. So the robots, the big thing at these competitions is they have to go out and score points on a table. And every year, those missions change and what the robot has to do changes. And it's the exciting part when that's released. It was released officially last Friday on September 2nd. But this is the first time in Juneau where we'll have the full mat out and all the missions built and our head referee there to go over the rules with kids.
So this is at JDHS.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it starts at 5:30. So I'm going to go there right off to work. Are you going to feed me?
We'll have some snacks out. Don't expect dinner. But we will have a couple snacks out, and the hope is you'll be so entertained that you won't notice until you're starving at 7:30 and can head straight to dinner.
Is there a cost for being involved in the
There's league? Absolutely no cost in the kickoff event. Some teams do charge based on what their expenses are. So, again, that depends. You need to talk to your team and figure out how it's going to work. But there's absolutely no charge for the event tomorrow night.
How big's a team?
A team is 3 to 10 kids. For the littler guys in junior FLL, we say 2 to 6. That's where they're really beginning to work on those team-building skills, and 2 to 6 seems to work a lot better.
Juno FLL means First Lego, Junior First Lego League. That's
right.
The kindergartners and up to first grade.
Right.
Up to third grade, actually. Okay. And then where does this eventually go? You said that the program goes into high school, junior high school, and high school as well. So we're up to the eighth grade with these two groups that you're meeting with tomorrow night. What's the next step after that?
So the next step after that is the first tech challenge, and those are the high school teams, which we've had at both Thunder Mountain and JDHS. And those teams practice where they have four robots on the field at the same time. They're no longer built out of all Legos. They start to bring in Tetris pieces and some other. They can use a shop to really make the robots a lot more sophisticated. They have some other sensors that they have access to. And the competition is more intense because there's actual contact between the robots. So you're dealing with offensive and defensive strategy, not just your own robot and what's going on your field. And the games are just a blast. And beyond that, we want these kids to get into solving the problems that we're dealing with in LEGO League. So they're moving into industry. It's one of the reasons why I get to do this at work as part of the Juno Economic Development Council. The idea that these kids are really gaining the skills that we want them to have when they enter the workforce after graduating high school or after college.
So I have a friend whose child was involved, I think, in a high school competition outside, and it involved they had to lift a certain number of objects. The robot had to mm-hmm. lift a certain number of objects and place them and like that. Is that typical of the kind of activity that goes on in the
advanced? Yeah, this year's competition, they have, for the high school competition, they have four robots on a field, and it's a bowling competition. So there are actually 2 6-pound bowling balls on the field that the robot can move to knock down. Then there's also racquetballs. And two robots are working together on a team, and the other two are against them, trying to score their own racquetballs in different places. And you can restack crates after you knock the crates down and move the bowling balls to different places or use the bowling balls defensively if you want to. It's, like I said, it's a really exciting game.
So to recap now, the event that is coming up, the first thing that people can do with this LEGO League is tomorrow night from 5:30 to 7:30 in the evening. It's at Juno Douglas High School. Basically, it's free. Come on over. There'll be some snacks. And this is a demonstration of some of the technology, but it's also with it as a coach's clinic for adults that are thinking that they might want to become involved in it.
Yeah, the idea is really to start off teams. It is actually a kickoff. So kids will set you up with the skills that you need to get started on your team, and adults will get you set up with the skills you need to start off coaching. The other thing we're looking for is this year's challenge is food factor. We're always looking for people who have some expertise, so fish processing or Fred Meyer, if you're a chef in a restaurant, anybody who deals with food safety on a regular basis and has something to share. If you like working with kids, it sounds like a cool event. If you like Legos, come out and we'll find a way for you to get involved, share what you know with kids, and just add more to the overall first LEGO League.
Wonderful. Becca, thank you so much for sharing this with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
As a parent, you're probably aware of the advantages of homeschooling, but what type of program is best for your student? You might consider HomeBridge, a program associated with the Juno School District that offers involvement in school district programs like sports and other extracurricular activities. Another HomeBridge advantage is the allowance of up to 2 classes at a local high school with no allotment reduction. Your student can learn at his or her pace and still be connected to friends in the school district. Homebridge, Juno's hometown homeschool, 209-HOME.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 13th of September, 2011. It's the birthday of Sherwood Anderson, born Camden, Ohio, 1876. He suffered a nervous breakdown in 1912, and that decided him to become a writer. And he was a big influence on writers who followed him. He encouraged William Faulkner, and he also wrote for the young Ernest Hemingway a letter of introduction to take with him to Paris. It's the birthday of J.B. Priestley, born Bradford, Yorkshire, England, 1894, novelist, playwright. Priestley, who said, "Most writers enjoy 2 periods of happiness, when a glorious idea comes to mind, and secondly, when a last page has been written and you haven't had time to know how much better it ought to be." And it was on this day in 1848, a railway worker named Phineas Gage, working on a crew near Cavendish, Vermont, using a tamping iron to pack explosives into a hole in a boulder. The explosives went off and drove this tamping iron through his head. It was 43 inches long, an inch and a quarter wide. A doctor cleaned the wounds and saved his life. And Phineas Gage inspired new areas of brain research, became one of the most famous patients in neuroscience. To people researching a connection between brain injury and personality change, and also trying to map the brain and which areas of the brain control different functions. Two-thirds of all psychology textbooks mention him, Phineas Gage. Here's a poem for today by Charles W. Pratt, The Merger, for my son. Trying to think of something useful to say about marriage. I remember a morning when I was 20-plus, self-absorbed in my tinny pink Renault Dauphine, my little toot, and I tried to get by a tank truck on a bendy road too briefly straight. Shuddering, pedal floored, my frivolous vessel leveled with the cab like a pilot fish by a shark's grim grill. Then there was a car ahead of us, and as I tried to floor a pedal already on the floor, the blue of ice I hadn't seen, spinning toward the implacable hugeness of the cab, looking up into the eyes of the truck driver, I felt only the sweet certainty of submission, call it love, as if already I had left myself and could look down with the driver's godlike and loving eyes at a comical pink Dauphine sliding backwards down the road, then spinning again and into a snowbank tilted against a tree. One flat tire and a dent in the roof I pushed out myself. I made it to work on time. Because the truck driver had seen the oncoming car before I had seen the patch of blue, and had slowed to let me by. I met and married your mother, and you were born, and have grown up to meet and marry. And I have begun to understand the blind release of self to the will of another, and the answering, wise, dispassionate restraint of the merger we call marriage. The Merger, a poem by Charles W. Pratt, from the box marked Some Are Missing, published by Hobblebush Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. And by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Scheutzker. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 3:33 at KTOO. This is Pat Moore. I'm standing in for Jeff Brown, who normally is the host of Juno Afternoon, but he and I are working out an arrangement where I'll be taking over some of the shows, and today is one of those. My next guest is Sarah DeLeo, and Sarah's here to talk to us about the 25th anniversary of an organization which plays a real prominent part in Juno activities, and that's SAGA. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm just fine. And you look like you're just fine, too, today.
I am. I'm doing very well.
We're coming up on the 25th anniversary, but I think the first thing I'd like to ask you is, what does SAGA stand for and what does it do?
SAGA is the Serve Alaska Guidance Association. It provides service learning opportunities to youth in the community, as well as from the lower 48 in Hawaii. They have several programs where youth work to improve the lives, lands, and communities throughout Alaska. It's kind of their tagline. I am involved in one of those programs, which is known as Connections. I serve directly through SAGA as an AmeriCorps member. I'm a community volunteer specialist, and part of my duties are to plan events like what's coming up on the 24th through 27th.
So what is coming up on the 24th through the 27th?
Well, on the 22nd, one of the programs, the Alaska Service Corps, will be graduating at Centennial Hall, and that's from 2 to 4. The main thing that I've been focused on recently is National Public Lands Day, which is coming up Saturday, September 24th. The Forest Service is going to be having a ribbon-cutting ceremony at their Nugget Falls Trail, and since it's the 25-year anniversary of Saga and 25 years of working with the Forest Service and the ribbon cutting, it all just kind of comes together very nicely. So we're inviting members of the community, if they'd like, to come at 9 a.m. to the main bus parking lot, which is right next to the visitor center, gather there for a little light breakfast orientation, walk over to the ribbon cutting at 10, which will be followed by some trail work to help obliterate the old Nugget Falls Trail that most people probably can think of walking through that marshland. It floods, so we're going to get rid of it. And the new one is very nice and will be opening up, like I said, very soon. After that, around 1:10, there's going to be a group photo and a 25-year PowerPoint presentation at the actual visitor center. And people are welcome to stay straight through 1:30, 2 o'clock as things wrap up, or they can leave, you know, as they please.
Where's the Nugget Falls Trailhead?
The Nugget Falls Trailhead is if you're walking like you want to go towards the Nugget Falls, and the pavilion is on your left and the visitor center is on your right, and you're walking kind of like you're going towards Photo Point, you'll notice at the moment it's all roped off with road cones to your right. That's going to be the new start to the Nugget Falls Trail. The old start is just a few feet beyond that. There's a little sign there, and you can obviously see the falls in the distance.
How long is that trail?
You know, I don't know. I'm just going to estimate that the new trail is maybe half a mile, three-quarters of a mile.
Okay.
I don't know.
So it's pretty much a flat walk.
Yeah,
it's comfortable for people.
Very much.
If someone were going to this event, as long as they had rain gear and appropriate clothing, they could probably plan on taking the walk as part of the.
Sure. Yeah. If anybody who is up to it is more than welcome to show up, and we would be more than happy. All ages, all abilities, physical, you know, whatever you're comfortable with. Bring your rain jacket, and we'll supply the rest. If you have work gloves, I would suggest bringing those too. If not, maybe just plan on having some rough worked hands.
Okay, and the date for that event again is?
That was September 24th. It starts at 9, and it goes till approximately 1:30, 2 o'clock.
Okay, if we could back up for just a moment. You said that there was the graduation of a group of people on the 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
What's that group, and what are they graduating from?
They're graduating from a term of service with AmeriCorps, and they've been serving through Saga, doing trail work and DOT work throughout the state. I don't have numbers as far as how much they accomplish every year, but it is significant. And Saga is simply, you know, showing their appreciation for these young people's culmination of their term of service. It's something to be proud of, for sure. And we're just incorporating it on the general list of events.
And that event's open to the public? People want to attend?
It is. Just keep in mind that it is geared directly towards the participating people and their significant others or, you know, co-workers.
So after the event then on the 24th, then what's next on this 25th anniversary?
Well, then the Forest Service has some screenings that they're going to be showing on the Friday the 23rd. Excuse me. Yes, Friday the 23rd. I should back up and say that that's obviously happening before National Public Lands Day. My apologies. Friday and Sunday, there's going to be film festivals at the Visitor Center. On Friday, it's from 7 to 9 p.m. It's free admittance. They're showing the Jackson Hole Film Festival screening. And then on Sunday, September 25th, from 2 to 4 p.m. as well, the Jackson Hole Film Festival screening at the Visitor Center with free admittance. And I should point out that this is all tied into a International Year of Forests, which people may have seen those posters up around town. It's the initiative to celebrate our public lands. And this is coming from the United Nations, put this together. So this is the local way of celebrating this international celebration of our public lands. The final event is going to be Tuesday, September 27th. Amy Gulick's popular show, The Salmon in the Trees, is going to be at the Jack. At 5:30, there'll be an opening reception with Amy Gulick. At 7 p.m., there's going to be a slide presentation by Amy Gulick. There's free admittance. It's open to the public. And the exhibit does run through October 29th. And that portion has been set up by the Forest Service.
The details on that exhibit, what are we going to see?
It's going to be Amy Gulick's show. I believe, I know that I saw, I think it was at the Silver Bow a few months ago, if I'm correct. It's going to be her photography exhibit of the photos that she's taken and published.
Okay.
And if you do have any questions, you're more than welcome to contact me, especially if you want to volunteer on National Public Lands Day. My information is volunteer@servealaska.org. I can be reached by phone at 790-3091. And if you do have any questions specifically for the Forest Service, I would recommend contacting the Junior Ranger District, and they can direct you.
Okay. Can you give your email again for us? It's S-E-R-V-E Alaska?
Or? Yes, it is. Okay. Sorry. Okay. At .org.
Okay. .org. Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming down and talking to us about these things.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Sarah.
This is Bird Note. In early fall, California's Mono Lake bears witness to an amazing natural spectacle. More than 1.5 million eared grebes, or 30% of the North American population, gather here. For 2 to 3 months, these diminutive water birds feed on the abundant brine shrimp that thrive in the huge alkaline lake. During this time, the grebes will more than double their body weight while undergoing a complete molt. And by early winter, they'll be ready to migrate in a non-stop flight to more southerly regions. Mono Lake represents a vital resource for eared grebes and a vast number of other water birds. But as late as the 1990s, the lake and its crucial habitats were gravely threatened by the diversion of its water to Los Angeles. After years of court battles, the parties, including the lake's advocates and concerned scientists, came to a balanced solution. While the lake will take another 20 years to regain the water level now guaranteed by law, for legions of eared grebes and other birds, the story of Mono Lake looks like a conservation success. Today's show brought to you by the Lufkin Family Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's 3:42 here at KTOO, and my next guest is Lori Scandling, who's the Assistant Superintendent of Schools here in Juneau. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk today about the AVID program.
Right.
I'm an AVID listener.
No, I'm an AVID listener. I love to talk about AVID, and I'll tell you a little bit about it in just a moment, but I often like to start my conversations with people about what they think the acronym AVID or AVID stands for, and we've had some very funny submissions of the guess of what that acronym might be. One of them was I went to a staff training with a bunch of folks from our district to learn about AVID, and we started our time together with this kind of fun activity, and I think one of the AVIDs was Avenging Vampires in Douglas. So I can tell you that isn't what AVID stands
that isn't
for.
It.
No, AVID is a national program that is occurring in about 4,500 schools in our country and about 16 other countries as well. And AVID stands for Advancement Via Individual Determination. And it started over 30 years ago with a single teacher in San Diego who noticed that there were some kids who were making it against the odds. And she talked with those students and said, how is it that you not only succeeded high school, when maybe you were the first in your family to graduate high school. But more than that, you're going on to college. What is it? Because many of these youth, and still today, many of the youth, if not most of them, served by AVID are those who are the first generation in their family to go to post-secondary, whether it's technical school, two-year or four-year university. And the students shared with Mary Catherine Swanson the kinds of strategies that they learned in their high school education that gave them a boost or leveraged them into post-secondary confidence, post-secondary readiness. And they included things that for you and me, Pat, we're in the same generation. We're in our 50s, and maybe the protocols that I'm about to talk about are things that would be familiar to us because I know I learned them in school. And they are, for example, a very structured way to take notes, a way to reflect on your learning through nonfiction writing, a way to work in groups to help each other learn through study protocols, which prompt and support your peers to get through the learning dilemma and find their way to the answer of whatever they might be stuck on, to understand how to read for meaning and how to take apart text, whether it's using highlighters or your notes on the side or in the margin, and then how to get ready to show what you know. And this is not rote learning. This is a process for learning. So Mary Catherine Swanson, some of us call her St. Mary Catherine, pulled together an elective that she began to call AVID. And in that elective, students learned how to do school. Today, if you were a teacher anywhere in the United States, I think you would see that students not always are ready to know how to do school. And school is a complicated system. And there are certain practices that help you be more successful within that system. So the AVID elective taught kids how to get organized, how to keep a notebook, how to take notes, how to be a fully benefiting participant in your class, how to ask questions of the teacher in a way that helped you as the learner, how to form study groups to plow through the learning that still held some mystery for you, how to do reading in an effective way. And again, all of this really is about good teaching and good learning. So AVID grew now to a very expansive system that, as I said, is utilized in thousands of schools across the country. Our new superintendent who joined us a couple years ago, Glenn Gelbrick from Salem, Oregon, had experience in the AVID program there and said, and truthfully so, that when he saw presentations by AVID students, he cried because of what those students gained as being part of the AVID family. A student in the AVID program takes an AVID elective, which provides the kinds of supports I just mentioned, every year that they're in the AVID program. So the AVID elective is always part of your day. The intent is then that your content area teachers, math, social studies, science, language arts, have also been trained in some of these strategies. So no matter what class you go into, that teacher, hopefully, will be practicing those strategies. And so they recognize that you're keeping a notebook. They recognize that twice a week inside that AVID elective time, you're going to have a chance to participate in what they call a tutorial. And I want to talk a little bit more about that because that's really my reason for visiting with you today. So we, 2 years ago, were fortunate enough to be able to utilize a portion of a federal Alaska Native Education grant that we received to focus on the transition between 8th and 9th grade and post-secondary preparation, and AVID became the vehicle for that grant objective. So we just completed our second year of training. We have about 60 teachers in the district who are trained in the AVID protocols and practices. And last year we had four cohorts of AVID kids, classes of 25, one at each middle school, one at each high school. This year we've doubled that, and our alternative high school has joined us as well. So a key part of AVID is participating in what they call the tutorial, where based on maybe a dilemma you're having in a learning concept, say in science or math or language arts, you cluster with a group of your peers during AVID elective time, and a tutorial facilitator or tutor, typically a college student or someone from the community facilitates the conversation to help you prompt each other to plow through that dilemma. We are getting ready to train tutors again, and I would love to invite community members who have an interest in working with youth 1, 2, 3 hours a week in a tutorial setting. If they're interested in facilitating teen conversations about learning, about specific areas that maybe they're stuck on in a chemistry class or math class or language arts, they would need to go through some training. We trained about a half dozen people last year, and we're looking to train cohorts this year. It's a lot of fun. It's really rewarding. It's different than any tutoring you've seen. When I ask people, what do you picture when I say the word tutor, the vision is one-on-one, and that's not what this is about. It's facilitating a small group of learners to go through a process that helps them authentically learn whatever it is they're struggling with. And you're a teacher. You can appreciate that, Pat. Anyway, we're doing some training at the Bill Ray Center Friday, the 23rd of September, 8:30 to 4, and then half day on Saturday, the next day, the 24th. And if they so choose, then they can apply to be a tutor. We do pay $25 an hour. Not that we wouldn't welcome volunteers. We have small budgets. I think most people are aware we're in a challenging budget environment right now. But fortunately, we are able to support a lot of our implementation with this grant that I mentioned. So I wanted to mention the training.
Well, I have a couple of questions about someone who might want to become a tutor.
Okay.
You said that they need to engage in group facilitation, but it sounds like you teach So you're really looking for expertise in a particular area?
Nope. You don't have to be an expert in anything.
Okay.
I mean, it is helpful to know. Let's say you're working with a group of 7 kids who are working on a, let's say, an Algebra 1 homework project, and they're just kind of stuck. It does help if you have enough grounding that you would know, whoa, they're way off on the wrong track in their processing. And it's one at a time presenting whatever dilemma they're on to the group. And the group prompts them with, well, what do you know so far? Show us where you got stuck. Have you looked in your notes? Have you looked in your book? So if there were really a system that went haywire, it would be helpful if you had some background knowledge to go, you know, I think we need to revisit this. Let's go back. Show me why you think that you're on the right track. So the job of the tutor is to redirect or to prompt. But honestly, you could facilitate any of those content area groups without having a deep content knowledge. It's about understanding a process of probing and prompts and not jumping in and giving the answers, but making the students own their own learning.
You said that this training for tutors lasts from 8:30 to 4?
Uh-huh, on Friday, the 23rd of September, Bill Ray Center.
Uh-huh, that's quite a long stretch.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to decide to come to this, then...
Will you? I want you to sign up now.
Let me think about it.
You'd be good, Pat.
Give me a couple of minutes.
Okay.
Okay. And what day of the week is that?
That's a Friday.
A Friday.
Yeah,
so
that's
you're
in
not gonna...
a week from this coming Friday. So Friday the 23rd and half day on Saturday the 24th.
Okay. The difficulty that I'm envisioning here is that if someone wants to volunteer to do this kind of work and they are working themselves, then how do they become involved and how can they become trained?
You do have to go through the training. I really admire the National AVID model because they do expect fidelity of implementation. You're not an AVID school if you're not using the AVID strategies. And in fact, there are 11 essentials that make you an AVID school, and you do a self-study twice a year to measure yourself against the essentials. Part of that is having tutorials with trained tutors. So unfortunately, if you could not participate in the training, you can't be an AVID tutor. But let me give you an example of the kinds of folks who tutored last year. One was a person who had a part-time job and was interested in expanding her experience in the community. She was new to the community. Another was a person who had just moved here. Her husband had a new job here, and she was formerly a teacher in another community. And it was too late in the year to get a job, but she was interested in getting to know the youth here and getting to know the schools. We had another person who substituted some days of the week. She was a teacher who had recently returned to town, and she didn't want to sub every day. She wanted a variety of experiences, and so she became an AVID tutor one day a week and was able to sub on other days of the week. We have college students who have schedules that allow them to go to their university class maybe Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then they're a tutor on Thursday. You can get college credit for going through the training. And we encourage college students because they're role modeling the college-going disciplines that one needs to survive in college. College can be rather merciless, and you're paying money for it, so you may as well maximize your experience. So those are the kinds of people that have been attracted to the AVID tutoring. This year we've had interest expressed from a retired teacher who was going to move away and be done with it all and kind of misses the educational milieu, and so she's going to participate as well. So it could be a variety of people such as yourself who maybe have some time. It could be 1 hour a week. It could be 2 hours a week. It's certainly not a full-time job, and it depends on the schedule of when the elective is occurring at either of the two middle schools or any of the three high schools, including Yokosuka-Dakahiti.
So assuming that you've sold me.
You're smiling.
I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
Anyway. What do I need to do in order to be sure that I have a seat on this?
Well, thank you.
Details do matter.
So I'm going to give you the name of a wonderful administrative assistant who helps make this program run. It's an easy name, and I'm grateful for that. It's Marla, M-A-R-L-A, Marla underscore Johnson. And our suffix at the Juneau School District's a little bit long. It'd be Marla underscore Johnson at JSD. Oddly enough, for Juneau School District, .k12.ak.us. So if you can remember JSD, you know we're a K-12 system in Alaska in the United States, and Marla underscore Johnson is the magic name. She'll make sure you're on the list. We will provide lunch that day, and we do want to make sure we have enough materials for everybody. So it's a very interactive series of hours of training. Like I said, if you, as an individual, do decide that you want to become a tutor, you can qualify for a graduate credit or undergrad credit.
Okay. I think I have all the details I need now to make my decision. If I didn't remember Marla's email address, is there some way I could just telephone, and is there a number I could call and
sure.
ask for Marla?
Sure. I'm not going to remember now that I'm put on the spot, and I don't want to give the wrong phone number. So
okay.
You could drop me a phone call. I have an easy phone number, 523-1703.
523-1703.
Yep.
You could get someone to
yep.
Marla who was interested in this. And
I'd be happy
would be
to help.
Glad to.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pat.
Full picture, I think, of this wonderful tutoring program.
It is
Thank
a
you.
Wonderful program uh-huh. overall. I appreciate the time to talk about it.
Really good. Thanks. Listening to K2OO FM Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. K2OO is also broadcasting on these translators. In the Valley, in Auk Bay, you can tune to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, you'll find a better signal when you're driving through those areas or living in those areas at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201AM at 88.1. Hoonah is served by K220BT at 91.9. Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210AS. It's at 89.9 megahertz. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. Our sister stations KRNN can be heard on 872 and KXLL on 873. And we're also online at www.ktoo.org. Tomorrow on Juneau Afternoon, we'll be talking with Sheila Fisher and Brent Fisher about Saturday's Day of Play. You'll get details on the film The Road Not Taken, which is offered tonight at 8 on 360 North with filmmaker Steve Phillips. And we'll talk movies with Clint Farr and Pat Race. And your host, Jeff Brown, will be back hosting as usual on Juneau Afternoon. Weather tonight is mostly cloudy. The rain will be developing tonight. Lows around 48. We'll have light winds becoming southeast around 10 miles per hour late. Those winds will stay with us, and the rain will stay with us, and the highs around 54 on Wednesday.